There's a growing cultural debate over meatless meat. It comes with the move to replace meat with meat-like products made from plants, wheat, and some interesting ingredients. Scientists are also developing lab-grown meat. All that has some people hopeful that alternatives to eating actual animals will help the environment, animal welfare, and individual health. But the movement has brought about a question. Will changing definitions of meat affect how we think about our values? That's the question posed by Irene Lee, co-owner of Mei Mei Restaurant, author of the Double Awesome Chinese Cookbook, and food columnist for WBUR's Artery. And Irene joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Irene.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what do we know about the different kinds of meatless meat and what they're actually made of? You take something like an Impossible Burger, maybe it's impossible to understand all the ingredients that are in it. What do we know about the options?
So the Impossible Burger is completely plant-based, and one of the interesting aspects is that it, quote, bleeds like a real burger.
And so, it looks pink?
Yes, exactly. So when you're working with it as a cook or a chef, it feels and smells and looks a lot like real ground beef. And then, of course, when you cook it, you can cook it to medium rare, slice it open, and it's juicy in the middle. So there's an ingredient called heme, which is soy-based, and that is where that sort of bleeding sort of effect comes from. And I think the Impossible Burger, the folks who make it would like to say it's a pretty straightforward, you know, it has wheat and soy and potato. But definitely there are a lot of big words on that ingredients list. And some of them have not been consumed in large quantities, you know, by humans before. So there's some question about whether those ingredients are really safe and how they're made. And for a lay person, you know, we'll probably never really understand.
Well, and you write for WBUR's Artery about some of the questions that we still don't know. That's one. Another one is the environment. Environmental impact, right? Because sometimes there's perhaps a lot of use of fossil fuels to grow some of these plants to make the meat alternatives through conventional processes. And so it's not entirely clear that the carbon footprint will actually be lower in all cases, right?
Right. It's not so black and white. And I think one of the really interesting things when we talk about eating less meat, we're really talking about eating less industrially farmed meat. So factory farms. And of course, meat can be raised in all sorts of different ways. So at Mei Mei, for example, we focus on meat that is from animals raised on pasture. So basically, they get to live their lives outside. They're part of a more closed-loop ecosystem. And so when we think about meat alternatives, we're sort of talking about turning away from one very specific thing, which has this terrible carbon footprint, which is industrialized animal farming. But you're absolutely right. When we start looking at where all these ingredients come from for alternative meats, all of the energy and resources required to culture meat in a lab, strand by strand, we really don't know what the environmental impact of that could be.
Right. So when you talk about the cultured meat, this could be, in some cases, it is a meat product in the sense that it is meat flesh of some kind. It's meat cells, but it was never a living, breathing animal. And so I'm curious about that question that we were teasing earlier on. I mean, would that even count if you called yourself a vegetarian, but you were eating meat cells that were grown in a laboratory? It was never a living animal. So are you still a vegetarian if you're eating that?
That's a great question. As not a vegetarian myself, I can't speak to it. But I think that for most vegetarians, that seems to cross a certain line. And so the Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat and even lab-grown meat are really aimed at converting meat eaters to folks who eat less meat.
Okay, so how effective is that on the taste scale, right? I mean, this is really the key question if you are a meat lover. Now, if you don't eat meat because of ethical reasons or environmental reasons, perhaps you've already chosen something else. But if you are someone who's going to have a hard time giving up meat, tell us as a chef, I mean, does it come close? I mean, you have some delicious pork on your menu. Can you replicate that with something else?
Well, I think the smart thing about the Impossible Burger and products like it is that ground meat is a lot easier to approximate with plant-based proteins than I think, for example, a juicy steak would be. And so for a substitute for a hamburger, I think it does just great. And the question remains open, will these companies be able to develop sort of whole muscle fabricated meat products that can replace all of those other formats that we love to eat meat in?
You know, one of the things that was really striking to me about your latest piece was the culture around eating that you talk about, specifically when it's tied to meat. You use the example of a Thanksgiving Day turkey. There's so much history and family wrapped around that concept that, as you said, doesn't really seem to work as well with a tofurkey. Maybe
exactly.
It does for some families, but that would be a tough conversion for mine and I think for a lot of
mine
folks.
Mine too.
So how do we tackle that? I mean, there's so much else wrapped up into our eating aside from just what's on the plate itself.
Definitely. I think that when we eat, we're making a statement about our own values, about the people we are eating with. And I think that, you know, this is a great opportunity for us to really examine how we translate our values into what's on the table, particularly as we start thinking about, you know, what is the real environmental impact of being vegan or vegetarian? You know, is meat grown in a lab ethical in a way that meat that comes from a living animal isn't? And so there are a lot of cultural assumptions, I think, that we have about what it means to be vegan or vegetarian and what those values underpinning those diets are. But there's a lot of room for rethinking that.
So you must constantly be thinking about what you're going to do for your next seasonal menu, because I know that Maymay doesn't serve the same thing all year round, right? And so as you're sourcing your ingredients, how are you thinking about these questions? You know, where you're going to bring things in responsibly, whether it's a meat product or an alternative?
Well, I'll actually share that we have always worked on serving less meat than sort of an average restaurant, because I think more or less we agree that eating less meat in general would be a good thing. And so on our menu, you'll see that meat is a filling in a dumpling, or it's turned into a hash, or it's just one component in a sandwich that has lots of stuff in it. So in lots of non-Western cultures, having meat as a seasoning or just a small component of a balanced dish is pretty typical. So we're trying to do that. We also tried out Impossible Meat in a dumpling format, and it tasted pretty good. But I think the consensus among our team was that there was just something not quite right about it for us.
I see. So sometimes it just is maybe better to just pick an alternative that you know is different. I recently had a sandwich at your place that was, it featured a sweet potato. It's essentially almost like a steak, right? It was the sort of feature filling in that sandwich.
Exactly.
It wasn't going to fool me into thinking it was meat, but it was, you know, sort of filling that function.
Yeah. And I think that there are all sorts of ways to cook with real vegetables, not plant-based meat alternatives that are really delicious and ecologically friendly and don't require all of those inputs, all of that processing. You know, we peel the sweet potato and we cook it. So that's pretty straightforward. And with these meats, one of the things I wrote is that they don't really pass the Michael Pollan test, which is, would your grandmother recognize it as food? And are there ingredients that you don't know how to pronounce? And in the case of a lot of meat alternatives, the answer is no and yes, respectively.
Got it. I want to ask you about another piece that you've been very busy for us lately. And before writing about lab-grown meat and meat alternatives, you were also writing about immigrant-owned restaurants. And this line stood out to me. In immigrant-owned restaurants, diners' perceptions of authenticity correlate with low prices and high online ratings. Explain that. Why is that perception problematic?
Well, I think that as somebody who owns a Chinese-American restaurant, we deal with the assumption on the part of our diners that they're going to come in and the food is just going to be really cheap. And in some cases, it just doesn't matter how good the food is or the reasons for why it's so expensive. As soon as they see it's Chinese and it's not basically, you know, a bargain, then they're kind of out the door. And so for when we think about wanting Boston to have a more diverse and interesting restaurant scene, I think we have to consider, you know, what are we incentivizing? And for a lot of restaurant owners, it's a safe bet to make sort of cheap, reliable food. And so doing a high-end version of pho, for example, I don't know how well that would go over. People complain when pho is $12. Lots of people don't complain about pasta that's twice that much for even less food. But I think that there is a bias against sort of immigrant cuisines and especially those from the global south, which is authentic means cheap. And if it's not cheap, then it's not authentic, which means it can't be good.
And I imagine one of the issues there is that those diners' expectations lead to pressure on the restaurateurs to buy cheap ingredients and to pay very low wages.
Exactly. And, you know, in the past, there have been studies and writing about how cheap food necessitates cheap ingredients and cheap labor. And of course, to the extent that immigrant restaurant owners employ other immigrants, that creates this sort of alternate economy that is very challenging for business owners and for workers.
All right. Last question. Some of our listeners may have read that piece in the New York Times over the weekend about fire cider. And I know this is something you have on your menu. You've had it for a while. And there's this wrestling over who owns the term. Does anyone own the term? There is one company in particular in Pittsfield that believes they should be able to copyright it, and it is theirs. Where do you come down on this? I mean, can something like fire cider even be copyrighted?
I think for me, it feels a little ridiculous to copyright something like fire cider. It would be like copywriting, I don't know, lemonade or iced tea or an Arnold Palmer. And when it comes to food, you know, intellectual property is kind of a gray area. You can't really copyright a recipe in the way that you can copyright other things. So I love the idea that food and recipes are a place that is very open source and that we can share and we should share with each other. So for me, I think let's all keep making fire cider. We can make it the way we want. We can buy theirs in a bottle if we like. And, you know, hopefully we can all get along.
Maybe Arnold Palmer owns the copyright to the Arnold Palmer. But aside from that, I don't think anybody else could make the claim. That's Irene Lee, co-owner of Mei Mei and head chef. She's also the food columnist for WBUR's Artery and author of the new cookbook, Double Awesome Chinese Food. Irene, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.